This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
The following program is homecrafted and was recorded on January 27, 2021. The month of February has been formally recognized as Black History Month throughout the United States since 1976. But the history behind Black History Month itself actually began in the summer of 1915 during a celebration of the 50th anniversary of emancipation in Chicago, sponsored by the state of Illinois. Carter G. Woodson, an alumnus of the University of Chicago, who had been an exhibitor at the three-week-long festival, was inspired by the enthusiasm of the estimated 6,000 to 12,000 attendees and decided to form an organization dedicated to the scientific study of Black life and history. Woodson and his colleagues named the organization the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History. To promote and spread the historical information he and other Black intellectuals were documenting, the association began publishing the Journal of Negro History in 1916. Building on the success of this achievement and others, Woodson decided the association needed to formalize and promote an annual week-long recognition celebration of Black history and achievement, and thus establish Negro History Week in February of 1926. It is commonly thought Woodson chose February to celebrate Black history, among other reasons, because the birthdays of both Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass fall within the month, two Americans who play a prominent role in shaping Black history and whose legacies were already widely celebrated annually within various communities on those dates. These annual celebrations gradually caught on within Black communities across the United States, which in turn led to movements to build awareness and teach the information more widely to the public, and more specifically within the Black schools across the country. As early as the 1940s, Blacks in West Virginia, a state where Woodson often lectured, began celebrating February as Black History Month. And by the time the 1960s civil rights movement was in full swing, both activists and Black students on college campuses, who were increasingly seeking knowledge and awareness of their own links with African history and culture, led the charge to extend the week-long celebration to a month-long one instead. Finally, in 1976, the association used its significant influence to establish the proclamation, which has been made by every president since that year, formally recognizing February as Black History Month in the United States. Today, the association Woodson founded over 100 years ago is known as the Association for the Study of African American Life and History and continues to champion his work and legacy. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin and streaming live at co-op.org. I'm Michelle Manning-Scott, guest hosting the program this evening alongside regular host Bob Daly and our frequent guest commentator Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project. Our guest this evening is Dr. Ashley D. Farmer, a historian of Black women's history, intellectual history, and radical politics. Her research has been published in multiple scholastic journals. She has authored and co-edited two books and has written numerous articles relating to her research that have been featured in several media outlets, including Vibe, NPR, The Chronicle Review, and The Washington Post. Dr. Farmer is currently an assistant professor in the departments of history and African diaspora studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Welcome to the program, Dr. Farmer.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I was just going to have you start off this evening by giving us an account of your own history and what led you to your current profession. And maybe if you want to touch on if the history you learned either at home or in school growing up influenced that decision.
Yeah, Yeah, I love this question because it gives me a chance to talk about the importance of historically Black colleges and universities. I am the daughter of two Fiskites, or people who went to Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, where I was born and raised. And they were first generation and second generation college students, some who've had family members that also attended historically Black colleges, such as Tennessee State University. So we are a multi-generational HBCU family. And I think steeped in that is the idea that one must know their history and understand why HBCUs exist. So my mother was actually a student of history. She loved history very much and majored in it. However, for a Black woman in the South, you know, becoming a professional historian was not really an option. She first became a social worker and then eventually went back to school in her late 30s, early 40s to become a medical doctor. But she always read me bedtime stories, always had me having subscriptions to books that featured African-American leaders and figures, and was always teaching me about our history. Another story that I really like to tell a lot is that in the eighth grade, I had to do a research paper, and my dad took me to the Fisk University archive, and he was like, you can pick something in here to write on, you know? So it's no surprise when I think back on some of those stories as to why I ended up being a historian of Black history. However, I majored in French and Spanish in college and did not really fully understand that one could really be a professional historian in the way that I am for some time, because, you know, I lacked exposure to it in large part until college. So that's a little bit about my background. Once I went to graduate school, I always knew I wanted to study Black women. I thought I would study Black women in the Caribbean and French and Spanish speaking colonies. But my encounters with Black women who had been members of the Black Power movement really inspired me, and I shifted my course of study to study Black women activists and intellectuals in the 1960s and 70s. So my first book, Remaking Black Power, is about Black women and the rise and fall of the Black Power movement from about 1950 to 1980.
Got it. I do want to touch on that a little bit later. I recounted the history of Black History Month in my opening remarks because it is one piece of the Black history of America that I, and I would guess most of the population of the country, are largely unaware of. And it goes to the larger point that the history of Black America hasn't been purposefully taught to non-Black America up until more recently, that is. And even then, it's usually pared down to a narrative that is deemed palatable to white America. And so this ignorance and whitewashing of our history has helped to feed the white supremacist ideology and racism in this country. And I came across a quote by the actor Morgan Freeman, who said, "I don't want a Black History Month. Black history is American history," which I would guess is the sentiment of all Black Americans. So as a scholar of Black history, what are your thoughts on that statement? And if not a Black History Month, how do you envision getting more non-Black Americans to become aware of and acknowledge the non-white history we have long been told to pretty much overlook?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I agree with that. You know, Black History Month, I think, has a very rich history, some of which you already recounted, and is a testament to kind of a mutual aid in Black education in the absence or kind of the maligning of Black people at large, particularly in the early part of the 20th century. But that being said, you know, one month and the shortest month of that is not enough, because you cannot understand America. You cannot understand its economic foundations, its social and cultural foundations, how current events such as the insurrection that took place recently on January 6th come to pass, unless you understand that the entirety of the American nation state is built on the idea of white people being both in opposition to and in hierarchies against or diagrammed against Black people. So I do think that it should be pervasively studied more than just simply in February. And I think we have to start from the ground up. You know, I would say since the 1980s, 1990s, you know, as a product of the Black Power and Civil Rights movements, we really do have, you know, a broad range of scholarship and in-depth research in Black history in almost every way, shape, and form. The job now is for that to kind of filter down all the way through, you know, pre-K all the way up through 12th grade. Some of that has to be done by training K through 12 teachers. We do some of that work through things like the National Endowment of the Humanities that does summer sessions where academics like me teach K through 12 teachers and they take that back to their classrooms. But also that means having more teachers that look like the people that they are teaching and are invested in the communities that they're teaching in. To, you know, add in a segue, this is one of the main issues people talk about with the desegregation of white and Black schools in the 1950s, is did we lose some of that kind of ability to teach about our own community by people in our own communities. But that being said, it's got to be pervasive. It's also got to be state mandated in some ways, right? We know for a fact that we can't ever trust simply folks to tell people the truth about history out of the goodness of their hearts. There has to be some sort of, I don't want to say force, if you will, but requirement that there at least be some integration of Black history and Indigenous history, right? We're all living on stolen land, and Latinx history and Asian American history all together there.
Yeah, I would say I agree with that for sure. Well, let's get back to your book, Remaking Black Power, How Black Women Transform an Era. And it encompasses a good chunk of your research and writing that focuses on the contributions of Black women to the Black Power era of American history, which largely took place in the 1960s and 70s, I think, right?
Yes.
Can you talk more about that and specifically who some of these women were, what key influences they had on the movement, and how their influences may have ultimately led to the overall societal changes?
Yeah, sure. So my book covers kind of what I call the rise and fall of the Black Power era. Black power, we could think about as kind of a subset of Black nationalism broadly conceived. And we like to tell people that it centers around kind of three key principles: community control, self-determination, and self-sufficiency. Now, how Black people interpreted and expressed, you know, community control, self-determination, and self-sufficiency really, really varied and is not confined strictly, obviously, to the Black power movement. But in this particular moment in the 1960s and 70s, those ideas caught on like wildfire, along with a real cultural impulse to kind of center and understand the Black experience and to remove Black people from kind of these demonizing stereotypes about the way they spoke, the way they wrote literature, the way they dressed, the way their hair, what their names are called, everything like that. So the conventional wisdom is that Black men were the heads of the Black power movement and Black power organizations. Here we're thinking about people like a Malcolm X or Starkly Carmichael, and the Black women weren't really involved in it very much. But I think hopefully what people are realizing, particularly from discussions like our election most recently, is that Black women usually are there on the ground doing a bulk of the organizing and also a lot of the thinking and theorizing of what ideas of freedom might look like. So my book really charts how Black women engaged in those ideas of self-determination, self-sufficiency, and community control through multiple vantage points and multiple different approaches to Black power. To give you an example, I talk about women in the Black Panther Party and how they use Black Panther ideas about anti-imperialism, anti-racism, their class analysis to not only push for Black freedom, but also to push for women's equality within and outside the organization. I also examine Black women who were thinking more broadly about Blackness as kind of what we call a Pan-African project, meaning all Black people around the world are linked together, both by our shared oppression and culture, but also by our shared sense of freedom. And I talk about how they imagine themselves as part of a larger Black diaspora and how they travel back and forth, particularly to Africa in the 1970s, to kind of think about what global liberation for Black people and particularly Black women might mean.
Got it. And in the book, do you kind of highlight any particular women that were key to the movement back then and maybe are still influential today? I mean, I don't know.
Yes, there are key women that always come to the fore when we talk about Black power. Certainly Angela Davis. You know, there's a common misconception that she was a member of the Black Panther Party, but she was certainly friendly with many members of the Black Panther Party and is a key thinker that shaped these ideas of community control, liberation writ large. There's other Black Panther women like Elaine Brown or Kathleen Neal Cleaver, both of who are still alive today and speak widely, who I talk about as key forces, both as leaders and challengers of sexism within the organization. But I also talk about lesser known women in kind of the national or kind of cultural memory, such as a woman named Amina Baraka, who is Amiri Baraka, the famed poet and playwright's wife. And she was very, very interested in the cultural expressions of Black power and thinking about how if we could teach Black people to value culture and center themselves culturally, that could be a way to politicize them. So not only was she a very gifted artist, but she also was a key organizer throughout Newark, New Jersey, where they created basically a social safety net web, everything from schools, they had the African Free School, to co-ops where you could eat, to places where you could buy clothes, to political organizing meetings. And she took this model not only in Newark, but also tried to spread it nationally and internationally as well.
Interesting. Yeah. Names that I have not heard before. So certainly goes to the point of needing to reteach some of this or get this history out there in the sphere of public knowledge. Maybe you can also speak to some of the backlash that Black women have faced for the roles in these movements too. I think that's something to be said because I think Black women today, if you will agree, are kind of still trying to come out from underneath some of that oppression that's been forced onto them because of these strong roles that they've portrayed in society. And I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that in kind of two forms or two approaches. One is kind of backlash that they got for not fitting neatly into gender and race roles in that particular time period. And the other would be the backlash from the American government. So I'll take the first part. So in terms of backlash, you know, even though this was the 1960s and 70s, even though Black power is also happening at the same time that a gay rights movement is happening, the women's liberation movement is happening, right? The anti-imperialist movements are happening around the world. There still is a very clear prescribed place for women, and particularly Black women, that is not to be the leaders of any organizations, certainly not seeing them as intellectuals or thinkers or theorists, right, or writers in these organizations or of these movements. And the suggestion that they should kind of get behind Black men sometimes and let them lead and they follow. So those women who did not prescribe to those roles, and there were plenty, certainly faced backlash in that particular moment and also kind of not fitting ideals of womanhood, right, that Black women and particularly all women were supposed to face at that particular time. There was also a very intense program called COINTELPRO, which was short for Counterintelligence Program. That was run by J. Edgar Hoover out of the FBI, that J. Hoover was the director of the FBI. And his program, which lasted from the 1956 until the 1970s, was aimed at stamping out all civil rights and Black power organizers and organizing in under the auspices that it was a threat to American democracy and domestic security. So many of these Black women faced extreme amounts of government repression. When most people hear about this, they often probably think about perhaps the FBI harassing King. We now know that they did that, or harassing somebody like a Malcolm X. But one of the things I like to point out in my scholarship is that almost every Black woman in my book has an extensive FBI file that I have under the Freedom of Information Act. And they didn't have the same resources to kind of fight this government repression and the same kind of community rallying behind them to fight this government repression. And it affected their ability to hold a job. It had affected their children. It affected their families. And it also affected their kind of mental well-being. So even though some of these women haven't been framed as heroes or brave people, I want to emphasize just getting from sunup to sundown and fighting both of those fronts was extremely taxing, but they still did it because they believed in the ideas that they were fighting for.
Yeah, exactly. The whole FBI files on the civil rights movements and everything is also something that I have just recently really come to delve into. Ooh, a little bit more.
Thousands upon thousands of pages, I can show.
Yeah,
you.
Exactly. And that's just a little small fraction. I mean, even beyond the Black leaders of the civil rights movements, the influence of Hoover in those years is just outstanding. It's just amazingly vile. Outside of the Black Power era, what are some of the other historically radical political ideas and platforms that were maybe instigated by Black women? And are there any out there that have not been properly credited to Black women or even have been co-opted by other groups that we should know about?
You know, one of the things that I think has certainly been credited and documented, but may not be as well known amongst the mainstream, is this idea or what was a Black feminist movement. So many people learn about the feminist movement, or sometimes what we call the women's liberation movement, largely symbolized by people like Gloria Steinem and ideas like equal pay, access to reproductive rights and birth control, jobs, etc. But what many people don't know is that for all of these kind of white feminist organizations that developed in the 1960s and 70s, and some of them were we would call, you know, on the progressive side, meaning not really trying to change the structures, but get women into the structures, all the way to the radical side. And by radical, we mean, you know, totally upending the structures or ideas. There were white organizations that existed this way, but there were also many Black organizations and Black feminist organizations that existed that way. And sometimes this was because white feminists would not allow Black women into their movements or organizations. And sometimes this was not because necessarily they were barred from them, but they felt like they could not organize around their specific race and gender issues within white-centered feminist organizations, right? It is different to be a white woman in this world. You face different constraints in terms of economics, in terms of class, in terms of sexual politics. And sometimes Black women found that they just could not get their ideas and issues reconciled there. So in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a proliferation of Black feminist organizations, some that grew to national with multiple chapters around the nation. And it is from these groups, particularly one group called the Combahee River Collective, that we get the term intersectionality. Now, most people now use this term. It's kind of floated around all kinds of which ways, and it's kind of been divorced from its meaning. But it is in their founding documents, and they were a radical Black feminist group founded in the early 1970s. It is them who talked about the intersecting oppressions of Black women, meaning that we sit at the intersections of racism and sexism and homophobia and classism and all these other things, and that we can't organize individually around those separate identities, but we need to pull it all together. They are also the folks that originated the idea of identity politics, even though that meaning has been taken away from their original kind of work. So many scholars write about this group, the Combahee River Collective, but many people don't know the origins of this outside of scholarly circles. And I just want to be clear here, they were the ones that came up with the idea of intersecting oppressions. It was Kimberly Crenshaw, a lawyer, that came with the word intersectionality in the 1990s, but she was describing and relying on the Combahee River Collective.
Yeah, I was just about to say, you know, that term is something that's been noted a lot in the past couple of years. And that, yeah, I knew it was Kimberly Crenshaw. So when you started talking about it, I was like, but I thought that was Kimberly Crenshaw. So yeah, okay, I get it. I get it now. I get it.
So they said intersecting, she put it all together. But yeah, so I mean, you know, but the larger point here is that, right, there's a longer lineage of Black women talking about what we now understand as intersectionality, even if they weren't naming it as such. And that, you know, the Black feminist movement of the 1970s was a key point in which those ideas started to really formulate and germinate in the public sphere.
Interesting. Okay.
Dr. Farmer, I would be curious what your take is on Stacey Abrams right now.
As a fellow HBCU, great. Yeah, I think that she's fantastic. I think I am appreciative of the ways in which she lost an election, and then instead of turning her back on everything and being upset, which presumably she had every right to be, she dug in and played the long game. And I think in the process of really sitting down and engaging in fair fight and getting people enfranchised and getting the vote out, she has really offered us a renewed sense of what grassroots organizing can be, the importance of playing the long game, understanding that freedom is not something that comes through one election or one kind of historical moment. And I feel very excited by the prospect of what her successes have taught a newer generation about sitting down, engaging in grassroots activism when and where they are. To give you an example, you know, I have students here at UT who were very frustrated by Beto's loss in the midterms previously and asked me if I thought that such a thing that happened in Georgia could happen in Texas, right? And I said, yes, right? There's a Stacey Abrams in every state doing this kind of work. The key here is to find and promote and engage and then also get out and knock doors and do that kind of work themselves. So I think that she is a brilliant political strategist. I think that she understands the changing face of the Democratic Party. I think she understands crucially the widespread effects of repealing the Voting Rights Act and what it has done for the shape of our country today. And so, you know, I'm very excited to see about what she does next. I hope that she tries again to hold an office.
Is there a particular political philosophy you see operative in her? Or is it basically just organizing?
Like most organizers, she writes prolifically about this and also romance novels just on the side, which I enjoy about her. I don't see her, even though people emphasize her work with voter enfranchisement, from my own reading of her, and again, you know, I always encourage people to go to an organizer's own words about this, and she has written, like I said, multiple books, it is plentiful about this, is that she's not a vote or die kind of person. She sees the vote as part of a large web of what one needs in order to be considered fully a citizen and engage in a different kind of relationship with the American nation state. And so I think one of the things that I find very encouraging about her is the ways in which she is trying to ask us to take the form of citizenship and the opportunities and relationship to the American nation state that we have now, but also push ourselves to imagine what we might like citizenship to look like, right? Or what kind of contracts we want with our government and government body beyond simply what they're offering us now. So I think she offers a very good kind of duality of sitting down and doing the work now, but also saying, don't be limited by what people are offering you as the only way to do things or the only way to constitute a set of rights or processes.
Great, thanks. And the other question I had too is, how do you see the contemporary role for historically Black colleges and universities?
I fully believe they are so very needed. I cannot, I know they are not for everybody, but I cannot stress to you how much, and I forgot to mention this at the outset of our discussion, but I went to Spelman College, so I too am a product of an historically Black college. I find them to be transformative on multiple levels. I find them to be sites that allow Black people from different places to come together and also to experience just a little bit of a cocoon of what it's like to be loved and centered in the midst of a world that's really trying to tear you apart and doesn't value your life. That being said, obviously there's been a decline in them as we have moved towards not being able to compete for students in the same way that these predominantly white colleges can. But I do think, like I said, they play a valuable role, not only in, just kind of the humanistic side of college development and a liberal arts education, but also, are just as good and just as rigorous schools as any PWI out there. My hope is, given, Stacey Abrams, given Kamala Harris, right, given the highly visible politicians that we now have that are products of HBCUs, that we begin to see a resurgence and students stop seeing them as places that cannot take them to high places.
We're speaking with Dr. Ashley Farmer, a historian and professor of Black women's history, intellectual history, and radical politics in the departments of history and African diaspora studies at the University of Texas at Austin. We need to take a short break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin and streaming live at koop.org. I'm your guest host, Michelle Manning Scott, along with regular host Bob Daly. This evening's program was homecrafted and recorded on January 27th, 2021. We're speaking with Dr. Ashley Farmer, a historian and professor of Black women's history, intellectual history, and radical politics in the departments of history and African diaspora studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Let's continue.
Backing up a little bit, you made a reference before about the Voting Rights Act, for example, and Stacey Abrams' work going forward with that. Do you have any sense about the trajectory of that? The issue, it seems to me, is that it was gutted by the Supreme Court. Do you think there'll be legislative efforts around that, or what do you think the strategy will be?
I mean, that's a good question. We need strong legislative efforts, right? I mean, there can be no question that after the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965, we saw an increase in enfranchisement in the Black electorate that then created not only considerable voting blocks, but people in Congress, right? First Black mayors, et cetera. And that doesn't necessarily mean that every Black constituency is going to elect a Black person, but we see it as a viable pathway for Black people representing Black interests, right? I do not see a world without any kind of federal intervention, we could get that back. That being said, I am not a person who thinks that voting is the be all end all, nor that we can depend on the federal government or top down legislature to do that kind of work. I think what the past years have taught us, really going back, I guess, the midterms before the election of Trump, right, is that you must be vigilant about the right to vote. You must be vigilant about the ability to take it away and who it's bestowed upon. And you must be vigilant about how districts are drawn in order to enact your vote. Without the combination of well-done federal legislation, but also grassroots groups like Abrams and others who are watching to make sure that states fall in line and educating folks, beginning post-politicized about it, I don't see us going back to that place.
Interesting.
Along those lines, you penned the article I came across in the Washington Post last fall, just detailing the historic nature of the 2020 election cycle, especially as it pertains to Black women, because there were a record 130 of them across all political parties that filed to run for Congress, you said. And the numbers are historic, but I think part of the point of your article was that the actions themselves were not historic. It's past social movements have been a catalyst to propel Black women and women of color into formal politics. Where do you see this new crop of Black political leaders taking us at this point? currently, I don't even know if you know this, is it currently there's 25 Black women in the U.S. House of Representatives at the moment?
I'm not sure of the exact number. Yeah. You know, I'm not exact. So, you know, the point behind that article was just, I wanted people to see the cyclical nature or historical processes in action. It is our first kind of proliferation of Black Congress people, and particularly Black women, was in the aftermath of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But also social movements such as the Civil Rights and Black Power movement, where people became politicized around these issues, fought for those who they felt represented their interests. And also there's kind of a mainstream opening to say that something's got to change. We should let some people kind of into this door. My point there was that it's not a coincidence that we are seeing a record number of people both run for and be elected to Congress in the aftermath of this last slate of Black Lives Matter protests going back to the killing of Mike Brown. That being said, we have real questions about what can be done there. So I'm very excited about somebody like a Cori Bush. I think that she understands who she represents. She is of the people that she represents. And the way she came out guns blazing in the impeachment hearings from day one has given me hope that she will stay true to the principles on which she ran on. But there's real questions, even with the Democratic majority, what can be done here. It's a short majority, right? We know that the Republicans are going to try everything they can to stymie this power. And there's still very much an old guard in the DNC. I mean, I have to say, one of the things that is incredibly frustrating to watch in somebody in the, you know, I'm not the youngest, but younger group, I like to call myself an elderly millennial, is the inability of these young Black and Brown women to really push forward a more leftist agenda for the corralling of the older part of the middle of the left. I think there is a moment in which this kind of agenda or progressive leftist agenda is going to be pushed through. We're probably in it. I'm hopeful of these women and their ability to lead it, but I have real questions about the party's ability to stand up to Republicans and the party's ability to move to the left on these issues instead of kind of holding their ground in their center as they've done for so many years.
Yeah. And I guess part of that whole incoming class of women into the House of Representatives, it leads into one of the thoughts that's kind of bantering around right now is that Black women have saved our democracy. And I kind of wanted to touch on this because I did also come across an opinion column in the Washington Post by Christine Emba, I think it was in the beginning of January. And I'm kind of quoting her a little bit here. She said, "This clamor is meant to be flattering, but it feels more than a little demeaning. In certain respects, Black women may have saved America, but Black women didn't sign up to be America's saviors, and they aren't doing it for the benefit of Twitter fans or social media influences. They are supporting democracy so that they and their families and their communities can thrive." I just wonder what your thoughts on that whole thought is. I don't know if I'm making sense or not.
Yeah, no, I'm certainly in line with her. I mean, I am resistant of this kind of Black women as savior complex. Black women have always been, to paraphrase Zora Neale Hurston, the mules of the earth in this country, in the sense that we're always moving things forward and along, whether that be just making sure people get by from the days of slavery to making sure that we don't descend further into fascism in 2020. I think that it also kind of plays into these ideas of Black women as superhuman. And the seedy underbelly of that then is that then our humanity is denied when it needs to be humanity. And one of the things that has kind of been the constant refrain is that our lives matter and that we're human beings and in need of the range of support and emotions, et cetera, that human beings have. But there's this kind of superwoman complex that's being put upon us that I think is undermining that kind of seeing us as real people or real human beings. I think that she's exactly right. We are the bottom of the totem pole in many ways, right? So whatever we do something for ourselves, the rest of the nation necessarily benefits. That's really how it works. The goal here, or the best way to support Black women in this, is then to address those needs with the understanding that when Black women's lives get better, everybody's lives get better, right? That's really where I am on that. That being said, I do think that we would all benefit from seeing the ways in which Black women are the most trusted and sturdy voting bloc of the Democratic Party, in addition to being some of its kind of most progressive leaders. And instead of continuing to ride the middle for the hope of getting some white folks that truthfully are probably not going to come around on this, we might do better off to form coalitions with white and other people who feel and think similarly minded, and push forward an agenda that has Black women at the center. Again, not because we're the only people that are in need of things, But just because, like I said, if you think about the bottom of a ladder where somebody's at the bottom, if you push that bottom rung up, all the rest of the rungs go up.
Precisely. Yes. That's a sentiment that's not understood by a large majority. And I just think it needs to be promoted more and more that that agenda that so many people deride, I think, is something that is ultimately what we need in this country.
Yeah, like, I mean, full enfranchisement doesn't just affect Black people or Black women, right? There are plenty of people that are not Black and brown that are disenfranchised for a variety of reasons. You know, why would that not be productive, right? A standard minimum wage would certainly help Black and brown people the most because we work those kind of jobs, but that also means that everybody gets a bump up, right? So it's sometimes a little bit baffling, the kind of politics we've gotten into where, well, honestly, but always the politics that we've had, where it seems as though a group is getting some kind of favorable treatment, when in actuality, typically that group getting that treatment or setting the bar higher for that group sets the bar higher for everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. Well put.
There's a lot of, let me just say, a lot of relief in the country right now, and maybe a tinge of hope as well. Could you share your own thoughts about where we're at right now? Here we are at January 27th. How have you been feeling, and are you optimistic going forward? Are you cautious, or what's your sense about things?
This is a tough question. I unilaterally believe that, you know, Trump being God is a good thing. In addition to being white supremacist fascist, right? He's also just inept at governing when we are in the middle of a strong federal government that can respond to the pandemic. That being said, I would say that I am cautious. What causes me worry is that things were so bad for the last 4 years that anything that Biden does is considered great, right? Because it's just not what it was before. And I fear that this won't allow people or allow space to push him to make good on some of those promises. Again, many of them to Black people, particularly Black women, as he said in his acceptance speech, under the auspices of it's just better than what we had before. I'm also cautious of a narrative where we're returning to normal and Trump was the aberration. The normal before was not good for most people, certainly not Black people and certainly not Black women. And the return to normalcy is more of the same. And many of the day-to-day structures are the same, whether we live on a Trump administration or a Biden administration. So I have real concerns about this idea that we're going to return to something that was better when, you know, better for who and better when. Third, I worry that then this puts more emphasis on Trump as a person, or maybe those set of people that were around Trump and enablers of Trump or the Republican Party, versus the real systemic issues that we face. I don't think that anybody can deny that we are going to be ravaged for years by this pandemic in ways that we haven't even begun to fully process and imagine yet. And we know that people at the bottom before it started are going to be the people that are worse off in the end. So this idea that we're all saved from what Trump was sending us to is just not true. And we really, and he is emblematic of what I think January 6th has shown us, a widespread belief system in approach to American life and American politics. So until we do something kind of systemically about that, until we have wholesale issues to address that, things aren't really going to get that much better. Those are the reasons that I am concerned. That being said, I am delighted to have somebody that is seems interested in effectively governing. I am hopeful for the harshest forms of American white supremacy to be dulled, but I don't want people to lose sight of the fact that dulling and blunting is not meaning it's not there.
What role do you see our first woman of color vice president playing in all this? How much do you think she's going to keep the narrative moving forward, or how much influence do you think she'll have in keeping the narrative moving forward?
This is difficult for me. You know, I mean, I go back and forth. I don't want to sit here and say symbols don't matter. But if there's anything 8 years of Barack Obama showed us is that, you know, representational politics don't really translate to everyday betterment of life, right? I am happy that she sits there as a symbol from an HBCU and as one about what Black women can achieve in this country. I am less excited about her ability to embody the kind of politics that I'd like to see the executive office embody. I mean, her record as a prosecutor, case in point, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know that I really truly believe that, you know, Biden's a one-term president, right? For virtue of age, most likely. I'm not sure that I am either inspired or just actually convinced that she can be next in line.
Yeah. I've been wondering that myself too. Like, what's coming down the pipeline?
It's not going to happen. So, and you know, yeah. Trump is coming back. So, I mean, you know, this relief, you know, sure. But I will be shocked if this impeachment trial goes through with enough votes to actually impeach him. And the genie of him has been let out of the bottle. Obviously, he is the genie because those ideas exist every day for us. But yeah, I can't see a world where Kamala is a viable candidate. I hope I'm wrong, but I can't see it.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to end things by just saying that I understand you're taking the spring semester off of teaching at UT to focus on your next book. Are you able to talk a bit about it and when you expect to release it?
Yeah. So my next book is a biography. I'm taking a little bit of a different tack of one woman named Audley Moore. Often she is known in the movement as Queen Mother Moore. And she lived from 1898 to 1997. So almost a century of life over the 20th century. And there is no movement, moment, organization, kind of global radical instance in which she was not either there or part of the movement or considered an ideologue and leader of the movement. So the biography is a story of her kind of epic life as a radical Black organizer throughout the 20th century. But it's also really just a history of Black radical politics told through the vantage point of Black women who worked largely at the grassroots level to make some of the ideas that we now take for granted a reality. She's considered the mother of the modern reparations movement. That's probably her biggest claim to fame. She was also a mentor to Black power activists, Black Panther Party folks, heads of state in Africa, et cetera. So I really find her to be an unsung hero and intellectual whose kind of ideological imprint we live in. That's what I am working on now. The key problem we have in the pandemic is all the libraries are closed. And all the archives are closed. I had hoped it'd be out next year. I doubt that's going to happen, probably closer to 2022 or 2023 because of research delays.
Oh, well, I didn't even think about the fact the archives are closed and that you can't go and actually...
There's no research happening. Nope.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Still reliant on actual paper these days, I guess, for history.
Yes.
Well, good luck with that. Best wishes on that. I'll look forward to maybe talking to you in the future for that.
Yeah.
Bob, Jim, did you have anything else you wanted to talk about?
No, it was very informative. And thank you, Dr. Farmer, for all your work.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, this was really interesting for me. I've been so focused on Stacey Abrams lately and just still feeling so energized by what happened in Georgia, knowing that there were so many people before her who were so influential and consequential. Thank you so much for that.
Well, can I just say too, I don't want to always, sometimes, you know, historians can be a little bit of a Debbie Downer. I just want to say too, though, to your response about optimism, I do think that if there is one great takeaway, it is what Abrams and others in Georgia and those folks in Arizona, for example, were able to do. I really do think that it has renewed a fire for people for the power of grassroots politics and the ability of a group of people to shift the needle. And I think many of us started to feel very hopeless about that in this last administration. So I may not have very much faith in the executive branch or the symbolism of Black women in high places, but I'm extraordinarily inspired by the grassroots movement and kind of the shine that they are getting in this particular moment.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe there's not the Barbara Jordan out there in Texas we can kind of call upon, I'm hoping.
There is. It's not that far-fetched. I mean, I think if Georgia and Arizona showed you anything is that, you know, these places are far more blue. It's disenfranchisement and lack of coalition building. Like, it can be done. It can be done.
Well, thank you again for your time.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. Well, it's Friday afternoon, January 29th, and once again, we have our friend Austin Sanders with us. Austin is a staff writer from the Austin Chronicle and typically covers City of Austin matters, specifically the City Council, APD, and he's done quite a bit on homelessness also. Thanks for joining us, Austin. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing all right, Bob. Thanks again for having me on.
I really appreciate your report last week. That was pretty incredible. We had three concentrated stories about APD, the indictments and conflicts between council members and the chief, specifically Allison Alter and Chief Manley. We also had that story about that shooting in Southeast Austin. Any updates on any of those?
Not at present. I have not heard of investigation into whether or not officers participated in the Capitol insurrection. I haven't heard any movement on that. The indictments against the two APD officers, those are moving ahead to trial. We don't know when that will take place yet. And still trying to learn more information about the fatal APD shooting that occurred early in January.
But in the meantime, it sounds like the council is moving forward with more plans to deal with homelessness. What's going on there?
So this past week, we saw our first meetings of this new city council. We have two new council members on the dais, Vanessa Fuentes, elected to represent Southeast Austin in District 2, and Mackenzie Kelly, elected to represent Northwest Austin in District 6. In both campaigns, but especially in the District 6 campaign, homelessness was a central issue, as it has become for really all of the city, as these encampments of people experiencing homelessness have popped up in various parts of the city under overpasses and parks where camping is prohibited. But the CDC recommends against dispersing these camps as kind of a pandemic precaution. So they've been allowed to more or less stay in place for the time being. But it's created this really renewed attention on the issue following the campaigns and election, as we saw in the meetings this week. First, on Monday, council met for their work session, which they meet 2 days before every voting meeting, where they kind of talk about stuff on the agenda for the week. And that included a briefing from Diana Gray, who was recently named the city's new homeless strategy officer. So she's kind of the point person at the city to coordinate efforts across city departments, to work with other agency and nonprofits to address this problem. And one topic that came up that garnered a lot of attention is this idea of establishing designated camping areas. Essentially, these would be places throughout the city where people could pitch a tent, or perhaps they would have these kind of like tiny homes or other less expensive structures that could be quickly built to temporarily house people. Those would be sanctioned camping areas, and everywhere else would more or less be illegal to camp in, what the ordinances were like prior to the June of 2019 when council first amended them. This is a notable departure for where City Hall staff and council has been on the issue of designated camping areas, because in August of 2019, council, this was, you know, just a couple of months after amending the camping ordinance, council directed staff to explore this option to see if it was a good idea, if it would help, if they should be established. And staff returned with a memo saying, no, they're a bad idea. Basically, they have an illusory effect on homelessness. It makes people think that the problem is being addressed. But really what it's doing is it's concentrating these people into places where they're less visible. And so it makes people think that homelessness is reduced, but people are not being housed and offered support services, you know, the things that actually end someone's homelessness.
Right.
And staff said, you know, setting these up takes a lot of time, money, and other resources. And that even though they're often envisioned as like a temporary short gap solution, which I think council, that's certainly how they would envision them. Staff found, looking at other areas throughout the country that have set up these camps, once they're open, they're very difficult to shut down. They become lasting solutions, albeit much less effective than other permanent supportive housing type solutions. So essentially, you know, several council members expressed interest in exploring this idea and more or less asked staff to take another look. As Councilmember Alter put it, the city, as she says, is in a different place with homelessness than we were in the summer of 2019 when staff first rejected this idea. So she's one of the council members asking staff to explore this idea. The mayor supports it, Councilmember Ellis, Councilmember Tovo, there's a number that have asked staff to look at this idea again. It's something that I'm hearing from advocates, people at ECHO, that they're not totally against the idea of kind of sanctioned encampments, but they say that pairing that with criminalizing homelessness, as in making camping illegal again, is not a strategy for ending homelessness. It's a strategy for managing public spaces, which, you know, are important aspects of this work, but the strategy and the funding should not be mixed together. The funding for managing public spaces should be separate from the funding for ending homelessness through housing people. So that's kind of what I'm hearing on that front. On the agenda before council, when they met on Wednesday, was the purchase of two motels to convert into permanent supportive housing. And between the two, once the renovation work is done, it would create 148 units of housing reserved for people experiencing homelessness. And one of them was in District 7 on Burnett Road, represented by Councilmember Leslie Poole. She supported the purchase and it was approved unanimously. But the other purchase was in District 6 in Northwest Austin on Pecan Park Boulevard. And that district is, of course, represented by Mackenzie Kelly, who unseated Jimmy Flanagan in the December runoff last year. And she campaigned very heavily on homelessness. She has been very critical of council's decision to lift the camping ban or amend the camping ban and has called for council to reinstate it. But she did not want to vote on purchasing that motel earlier this week, which has caused a lot of confusion for people because she campaigned heavily on this issue. And staff and other experts say that this is the best way to reduce homelessness in the long term. But for Councilmember Kelly, she says that she has not had enough time to engage with her constituents, specifically nearby homeowners and residents and business owners that will, you know, be nearby this project, to kind of talk to them about what it'll look like. So she asked her colleagues to vote on a delay of the item, to vote so that she could have time to talk to her constituents about it, and then it'll come back to council the following week on February 4th at their meeting, where she says she fully intends to vote for the project. She just wants to have time to talk to her constituents and convince them that this is a good idea and it's not something to fear, but it's something to support. So that motion passed on a 7-4 vote. The four council members who voted against postponement because they wanted to approve the purchase that day were council members Greg Cassar, Vanessa Fuentes, Pio Renteria, and Kathy Tobo. They all more or less said that this issue is, in the pandemic, I guess, one of the most urgent facing the city, and even a week's delay is not worth it and can cause issues. So they wanted to vote that week. They lost the vote, so it'll come back to council on February 4th.
It'll be interesting to watch that. It has a little flavor of NIMBYism about it, but we'll see what she comes back with, you know?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And skeptics of Kelly's motivations will say, or have said, they fear that this is a way for her to buy time to figure out a way to outright oppose the project. I think it's notable that earlier in the week, before the council meeting, she tweeted a photo of herself standing with about 10 people opposing the project, not asking for a delay necessarily, but opposing the project. I noted in my story about this that one of the people held a sign that say, "Not on my dime, I pay taxes." I mean, there's a lot of implications in a statement like that that would suggest that person doesn't support this kind of project even after a delay. So there will be a lot of attention paid to how Mackenzie Kelly approaches this issue at the February 4th meeting and, of course, how she ends up voting. And, you know, I think it's important to know it'll pass even if she doesn't support it. I would imagine it would be a 10-1 vote in that case. But it would be notable if she ends up voting against this project, especially because she had been, you know, so adamant about her intent to support it. She just wanted more time to talk to her constituents about it.
Got it. Well, one other thing I just learned this morning, it looks like the city just hired a civil rights officer. I'm not sure what the name of the position is. Had you heard anything about this?
Yeah, so I don't have a lot of details on that, but this is something that was included in the budget this year for the first time. It's something that advocates have been trying to make happen for many years. And basically, they see this as a way of making sure that civil rights protections passed at the local level, like fair chance hiring, wage protections, things of this nature, are enforced by the city. So, of course, the civil rights officer will have duties beyond that. I think they're envisioned to play a key role in how efforts to reallocate money from the police department and how it's reinvested play out in the future. Yeah, this is definitely a victory for people who have wanted to see this happen in Austin for a long time.
Well, we'll get you back here hopefully next week. Look for more updates on all these stories. So thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you again for having me, and I'm happy to come back and talk to you now.
That's all for this evening. Thanks for listening. Have a good evening and stay safe, everyone.